This week, I'm wrapping up a great month of celebrating women in medicine. I've had some phenomenal interviews with some amazing physician colleagues, and it has just been so much fun to share these interviews with you. And today's episode is going to be just as good. You know, this podcast is meant to give you everything you needed to learn in medical school about being a successful physician that doesn't relate to the actual practice of medicine. There are a lot more awesome episodes that are coming up. We've got shows on leadership, personal finance, business management. It's all coming your way soon. And if you've been enjoying these episodes, I want you to make sure that you subscribe so you don't miss out on any of the upcoming episodes. That way they just automatically download for you. And listen, hey, if you have a minute, once you subscribe, hit that subscribe button. Take a real quick second. Just scroll down on that podcast description. Leave me a rating and review for the show. It really helps the show. It makes it easier for other people to find this content. And it keeps us relevant in the search algorithms and makes it more widely available to folks. All right, it's time to start the show. We got a great interview about how to succeed in private practice. You're going to love this. Let's kick it. It's feeling so good right now.
Feeling so good right now. Yeah. Welcome to the Scope of Practice podcast, where we help busy healthcare professionals learn to manage their businesses successfully and master their personal finances. Now, here's your host, Dr. Brent Lacey.
Hey, y'all. Thanks so much for joining me for the Scope of Practice podcast, where you can get the knowledge and resources you need to grow your leadership skills, your business, and your personal finances. Welcome to episode 47. You know, I've been having a lot of fun lately. Doing all these episodes has been great, but I've also gotten a lot more opportunities to do some one-on-one personal finance and career coaching. Listen, there's a ton of great content on the website and on the podcast, and it's all free, and I encourage you, take advantage of it, use it freely. But a lot of people just need a little more individualized help figuring out a long-term finance strategy, learning how to budget, figuring out how to get you and your spouse on the same page with your finances, writing a resume, figuring out which practice to join, or anything else related to your career or personal finances. I would love to help you so that you can have the successful career and the financial freedom that you deserve. Just click the coaching link in the podcast description and email me, and you can set up a free consultation to determine if one-on-one coaching is right for you. I have coached hundreds of families to eliminate millions of dollars in debt, get their finances on track, and build the successful career that they deserve, and I would love to help you do the same. So that way you feel safe knowing your career and your personal finances are as strong as you want them to be. Before we get into the show, here's a quick message from our sponsor, MR Insurance, a small business that helps physicians with their disability insurance needs. Michael L. Relvis is a CFP professional and insurance agent who is committed to helping physicians nationwide with their term life and disability insurance needs. He provides an objective, transparent, and education-focused process that aims to help physicians make prudent decisions and avoid overcomplicating things. He exclusively offers own occupation disability insurance policies for residents, fellows, and attending physicians. We really like Michael, and we know he's got your best interest at heart when it comes to disability insurance. We know he'd be happy to help you with whatever your needs are. You can find Michael at drpodcastnetwork.com/MR Insurance or contact him at 800-817-4522. That's drpodcastnetwork.com/MR Insurance or contact him at 800-817-4522. Today's guest is Dr. Sandy Weitz. Dr. Weitz is a pain management specialist who started her own private practice and grew it to 11 providers. She built a 25,000 square foot medical office building to house her clinic and multi-specialty ambulatory surgery center. Dr. Weitz also owned an anesthesia company, imaging center, and several other vertically integrated medical businesses. She ultimately sold several of her businesses to various partners and retired at the age of 53. Now, this all sounds amazing, and it is. But it wasn't without its challenges, as you'll hear her discuss with us today. Since retiring, Dr. Weitz is now teaching other physicians the business of medicine, just like I do. She is showing people how to maximize their earning potential by leveraging their core medical practice to segue into other business initiatives. This is going to be an episode worth bookmarking. You're going to want to return to this one over and over. There's a lot of great, individualized, actionable content. You're going to love this. I'm telling you, you don't want to miss out on this conversation. So here is my conversation with Dr. Sandy Weitz. Hey, y'all. I am super excited this week to welcome to the Scope of Practice podcast our guest, Dr. Sandy Weitz. Dr. Weitz, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. Well, so Dr. Weitz, I got to tell you, you know, when I first got introduced to you from Dr. Sharon McLaughlin as a mutual friend, and you know, when she sent me your stuff, I was looking at you know, some of the interviews, listening to the interviews that you guys had done, and looking through some of your stuff, and then you know, when we started talking, I realized, oh my gosh, I have got to get you on this podcast, because the whole point of the Scope of Practice is to encourage physicians to start and grow a private practice and believe that they are capable of doing business the right way. They don't have to be employees if they don't want to. And you know, there is still room for private practice entrepreneurship in this country. And you have just really done that over the last, you know, several decades or of your career. So
not quite several. How about a couple?
Well, wonderful. So, so you've done all that, and now you're starting to teach some other physicians how to do it. So can you kind of, you know, share some of your journey with our listeners who maybe aren't as familiar with you? You know, start with, you know, after training, you know, you started your own private practice, and how did that go?
Well, I actually am going to backtrack even before that. So I was a fellow at UCSF, stayed on faculty, worked for 5 years in academic medicine at UCSF. And basically, my husband and I realized that we were house poor. We were driving an hour and a half each way to our jobs. We had 3 little kids. We were both physicians. And we looked at each other one day and said, we got to do something else. And ended up moving, and I joined a anesthesia group. The anesthesia group told me, oh, absolutely, we need a pain specialist. The only problem is that when I got here, their version of a pain specialist and my version of a pain specialist had nothing to do with one another. They thought I was going to do blocks in the back of a recovery room, and I was a fellowship-trained multimodality pain specialist. And so after about 18 months, they said, I'm going to go out and start my own practice. Actually became the medical director for a pain program at our local regional hospital that has 1,000 beds. Actually, no, it has many more, but went to them and said, I'm happy to run my private practice and be your medical director. And they were like, oh, that's wonderful. Well, after about a year, I was so busy that I went to them and I said, look, guys, I'm bringing you the facility fees. I'm bringing you PT revenue. I'm bringing you all of these things. And I need to bring in another doctor. There's not enough hours in my day. I'm maxed out. I want to form a joint venture. And they said to me, well, wait a minute. We are the big hospital and you're just a peon. Why do we need to do a joint venture with you? We'll just go get some other guy or girl.
All too common a tale, unfortunately.
Absolutely. And I said, yeah, I don't think that's going to work. So I left. And at the same time, decided that I was going to go into private practice, knew I needed a space, temporarily moved into a office space in a different hospital with the intent of being there very short term. In the interim, we bought a over 2-acre lot and proceeded to build a 25,000 square foot medical office building. And you feel free to stop me if you want, but essentially what ended up happening was I thought that we would build space for my clinic and then we would have lease space for whatever other purpose, okay? We move into this building that has an ambulatory surgery center that I built from scratch on the first floor and initially my clinic. And then the upstairs was going to be this lease space. We were there for about 4 or 5 months. And I came home one day and I said to my husband, you're going to kill me. We're out of space. We need to renovate. And by this point, I had brought on another physician and I had 2 mid-levels that I had brought on in this time period. And we renovated. And long story short, and then we can move on to the how did this actually all happen? In the end, the upstairs became a clinic space of 12,500 square feet with 23 exam rooms. And the downstairs became a multi-specialty ambulatory surgery center.
Well, that is quite the journey. I love it. There's a lot to unpack there. So, and that's phenomenal. That's perfect. Cause I'm sure 1,000 people out there that are listening going, okay, I want to do some version of that. Okay, so how do I break that down? Well, let me back it up just a little bit. So you started your career in academic medicine, you said. So a lot of people make the transition from academic medicine to private practice, and you know, that can be kind of a daunting experience. So what was it that made you want to leave academic medicine? Was it just the thought of starting your own thing, or was it just that the situation at the university became untenable?
Well, so there were a couple of things. First of all, understand that this was in 1997, 1998, when UCSF merged with Stanford, and they thought that this was going to be the greatest idea. And in the end, they ended up getting divorced because it was a financially losing proposition for both. We took a pay cut every year that I was an attending at UCSF, okay? So I basically looked at it and said, as much as I love academics, we're, you know, a two physician family, and yet somehow we're struggling. We have, you know, $250,000, $300,000 in student loans. I cannot afford to take a pay cut every year. And so that's actually the reason that I decided to leave. And in that, decided to leave not only San Francisco, but leave the state to go to a lower cost of living place. And we spent 2 years really looking for the perfect opportunity. And it's hard when you need two physician jobs. But that's actually how we ended up. People go, how did you end up in Baton Rouge? Well, because it fit enough of the requirements. The cost of living was low. The incomes were higher, the potential for the incomes were higher, my commute was 5 minutes, and it basically met all of the criteria.
So you joined this group, or you joined this hospital program, and it sounds like they, you know, after the 18 months, it sounds like it was, you know, unfortunately, a very common story where, you know, we see this just all over the country. I get stories from people all the time. Like, my hospital thinks I'm a widget. You know, I don't feel appreciated. You know, I'm making all this money for the hospital. What about me? I mean, so did you feel like there was some things that could have been done differently, or should have been done differently, maybe on the front side, that would have prevented this? Was there any way to see some of this coming, or did this sort of come out of the blue?
Well, I think there are two parts to the story. First, I'm going to come back and tell you that I actually joined an anesthesia group that was not part of the hospital. It was an independent anesthesia group. And I worked for them for 18 months. Those are the people who thought that they wanted a pain specialist. It turns out in retrospect that they were in talks with the hospital, and the hospital wanted a pain program. And so the anesthesia group thought that they were going to use me to negotiate with the hospital. I parted ways with the anesthesia group because the vision was totally not aligned. Went and basically marketed myself to the hospital as, I'll build this program for you, but I want to be in private practice. In retrospect, I should have set up the joint venture from the very get-go.
Yeah. Well, and unfortunately, you know, there's, you know, when you're, you know, sort of out there on your own and negotiating with a giant hospital organization, you know, a lot of times you just don't have quite as many, you know, tools in your arsenal. I mean, it's like David and Goliath a little bit.
Except that within a year of my leaving, the pain program that I built at the hospital folded, and I inherited all of those patients.
So that's actually really a good thing for people to know then. So I know that I get these comments from folks all the time, like, you know, I just don't feel like I can say anything. I feel like I don't have any influence. I feel like I don't have any power. And what you're telling me is that you absolutely do. You have absolute worth, and, you know, the hospital needs you as much as you need them.
The hospital can't provide the service without me. Right? You can say that you have a multidisciplinary pain program with a pain specialist who can do interventional procedures, who can recommend psych treatments, who can recommend physical therapy, who can do medication management. But if you don't have the pain specialist who's willing to do all of those things, then you as the hospital don't have that service.
Yeah, it's so true. And so I think, you know, listeners need to get wise to that, you know, just because a hospital, or just because your employer says no, doesn't mean that needs to be the end of the conversation.
Correct. But you have to have in your own mind your list of what you want And you have to have the ability to say, you know what, I'm strong enough that I'm going to go and do this by myself.
That's awesome. Well, did you have any business experience prior to starting your own practice, or did you just kind of learn as you go along?
So this is kind of ironic. I was the youngest member and the only female on the finance committee for the Department of Anesthesia at UCSF. I think that back in the mid-90s, they appointed me to that really for diversity, so that they could check off and say, oh, we have a woman, right? The beauty of it is, at the time, I didn't realize that they taught me how to read a financial statement. And they taught me how to think about overhead and managing expenses and making choices. And so that was really my only business experience. Other than that, this has really been on-the-job training. And to that end, you know, it's not that I have another degree. I don't have an MBA. I didn't read a whole bunch of books. Some of it has been trial and error, but some of it has actually been using consultants who have guided me in various aspects, like how do you build a building? How do you choose a commercial realtor? I had a great commercial realtor who, you know, really helped us put together the pro forma to go get the loan to build the building I ultimately did. The key, however, with the consultants that I want to stress to your listeners is that it's not that they're the consultant and you listen to them. You listen to them and then you read everything they produce. Like if you have a lawyer who gives you a contract, right, because you want to hire a new employee, you have to read the contract. You have to understand the contract so that the next time you go to hire somebody, you already know what the contents of that contract need to be. Similarly, if you hire any kind of a consultant, you have to end up knowing most, if not the majority of what they know, because you're going to need that skill set going forward.
Yeah, that's a really good point. So, I mean, it sounds like you did a couple of really smart things there. One was, you know, just choosing to get involved. I mean, you could have said no to the finance appointment and, then you would have missed out on some really valuable education. So I think that's actually a really good point to make there is that, you know, if you're given an opportunity like that, you know, a lot of times we say yes to too many things and there's some validity to that, but committee assignments are not completely valueless. I mean, there's a lot of good work that's done in committees and there's a lot of great opportunities to learn. And you may learn things that you need 5 years from then, but you don't know that you need yet.
Absolutely.
Well, and also listening to consultants, and that's a really, really good point. And this is something that I stress when I'm talking to folks about finding advisors is, you know, think about it as like you're hiring a personal board of directors. Like you have a company called, you know, Dr. Sandy White's Incorporated, and you're getting a chief real estate officer, and you're getting a chief marketing officer, and you're getting a chief financial officer. And so those are that's your realtor and your accountant and your tax planner and, you know, the loan officer and all these people that you want to find people that have the heart of a teacher that can teach you stuff, but you need to pay attention and look for landmines and try to learn as much as you can and ask all the questions that you can so that you know that you're getting all the stuff that you are actually looking for.
Exactly.
So you said that, you didn't do, you kind of did a lot of stuff with trial and error, but you know, when you're starting out as a solopreneur, that kind of makes some sense. You know, you just kind of figure it out as you go along, but eventually you get so busy and so big that it's time to start bringing on more folks. You mentioned bringing on some more doctors. So what was the first hire for you? Was it another doc or was it a nurse or was it a mid-level or something?
Higher in terms of clinician being able to see patients was a mid-level.
Okay. All right. So your first expansion was to a mid-level. Okay. Yeah. And then how about what team members did you have when you first got started? Like, did you have a nurse, medical assistant, front desk staff? Like what was your team makeup initially?
So my very first, when I was renting space in the hospital that didn't want to do the joint venture, I had an MA. And I had a biller. And my biller was by far the most important person that got me started.
And why would you say that is?
Because basically she taught me a whole lot about how do you actually bill, not the mechanics of billing. Okay, the how do you submit a claim depends on the software you use, and the, you know, how do you deal with the you know, sending somebody a statement. I don't need to know that, but the how long does it really take to get a claim paid? What happens if I don't get that claim in the time that it's supposed to? How do I track my denials? How do I figure out how not to get denied? All right, everybody is complaining about, oh, we get so many denials. No, the issue is understand why you get the denials and then put the processes in place so you don't get the denials. Mm-hmm. You know, if you are burdened by too many prior authorizations, then figure out what do you need those prior authorizations for? And can you basically anticipate what you're going to need the prior authorization for and give them the information on the front end so that it's not so onerous trying to get the prior authorization? That's what that biller taught me now 20 some odd years ago.
So now when you start your new practice, then did you hire, was that one of the first people that you hired? Or did you just outsource it to a billing company or did you just do it all yourself?
When I very, very first started, I had a billing company and it took me not even 6 months to figure out that this was a losing proposition because I'd go meet with them once a month. They'd give me the reports and I'd be like, okay, what about this? What about this? What about this? And I realized that they were basically just going through the motions of doing the billing and not actually the thinking about it. And I see that as a problem. You know, I saw that as a problem then. I still see it as a problem now for a lot of people that I talk to. You actually have to actively manage the billing process. And whether you have a billing company or you have the biller in your office, it's not like you see the patients, you submit the charge, and then you're done. No, you actually have to go back and be on board with how fast are they submitting the charges? You know, how often are we getting denied? How you know, what's my AR? Is my AR growing? All of these things are things that you as the owner have to take responsibility for. And that's really what I learned in that 6 months when I had that billing company and ended up hiring my own biller.
Well, that's really smart. Yeah. And, you know, unfortunately, I mean, we don't get any kind of training. I don't know. I didn't get any training in billing and coding. Certainly, I kind of had to learn everything, you know, as I went along. But, you know, I tell you what, this is something for any of the residents or the fellows that are listening or the medical students. You know, one of the most valuable things that you can do for yourself if you are thinking at all about going into private practice is once a month or once every couple of months, just wander down to the billing office at your hospital and just ask the coders to or ask the billers to walk through a couple of your charts with you and show you what they were doing. I mean, you'll be amazed at how grateful those people are to learn, to realize that you are wanting to learn and get better because it makes their job easier and you'll learn a ton. And trust me, you know, it's one of those things that, you know, you're thinking to yourself, oh my gosh, you know, I'm already doing 80 hours a week. You know, I've never seen my family. Like, how am I supposed to spend the time on this? But it will pay dividends in the future. It really, really will.
Well, and it comes back to really getting paid for the work that you do. Okay. At the end of the day, there are only so many hours and so many patients that you can see. So you want to make sure that you are not leaving money on the table per patient that you see. And if you don't bill correctly, if you don't know how to code correctly, then you are de facto going to end up leaving money on the table. If you allow your AR to continue to grow, that's money that you should have collected. If you get a bunch of denials because that service was not medically necessary, you just did that for free. I mean, I have to tell you, when I would first hire a new doc straight out of fellowship, they would be like, oh, I want to do this latest, greatest procedure. We did it at whatever place they came from. And I would look at them and I'd say, that's great, but that's a training thing. If you do that in private practice, that is not medically necessary according to any insurance company. So we either need to get the patient to pay cash, which more often than not, they wouldn't want to do. Or if you want to do that procedure, understand that you can do that. But you're doing it for free and basically it's costing you money because you could have been doing something that you actually could have gotten paid for.
Yeah, 100%. It's costing you probably a lot of money in terms of, you know, lost revenue and in terms of cost of the equipment and staff time. And, you know, you're still paying for the expense of the room and all that. So yeah, that's important. Well, so at what point did you decide it was time to take on your first new physician to work with you?
So from the time I started my own practice, hired the NP probably 3 months after I started, and then started recruiting for a doctor almost simultaneously.
Oh, wow. So really, really quickly. So was the business just booming that quickly then?
The business was booming that quickly. But wow. I also had put together the financial projections, understood how much I got paid per patient, what my payer mix was, and then, you know, understood that I had a 3 month wait list to see me. So if I brought somebody in, I had a pretty good sense of what their ramp up was going to be. And the other thing, Brent, is that when you decide that you want to hire somebody, it's not instantaneous. You have to recruit them. You have to interview people. You have to find them, right? And then it takes time to get people credentialed. If you are not in the same city with me or stay in the state, then you need a license. You need to get hospital privileges, and then you need to get on the insurance contracts credentials. That's a 6 month process at least.
Yeah, I think 6 months is probably even optimistic. I mean, so as you're thinking about this, you know, any residents and fellows out there, you need to start looking for a job 2 years from the time that you're actually going to need it. I mean, no kidding. It needs to be that long in advance, because, you know, what Dr. Weitz is just saying right there is really, really important. So you can't get paid unless you're on insurance contracts. Well, insurance contracts aren't going to talk to you unless you have hospital privileges somewhere. And you can't get hospital privileges until you have a license. These are all things that have to be done in order. And each one of these things can be anywhere from 6 weeks to 12 months. I mean, I've had people that it took, you know, 8 to 12 months to get their medical license in a particular state because of whatever, you know, and so it can be a very long process. So yeah, definitely need to be looking at least 18 to 24 months out.
Well, I think that's true, whether you're the group that's looking for somebody or you're the doc who's looking for that job. I have to tell you that pretty much two things I want to say about this. Number one, if by July before I think you're going to start, you have not signed on with us, you probably are not starting on July 1 when you're done. Because as the employer, I'm not going to bring you on and start to pay your salary if you're not on any insurance contracts, because you can't generate any revenue. So you're basically dead weight that I'm responsible for. Similarly, if you're the employed doc who's coming out and wants to get started, it's really going to take you. And when I said 6 months, I agree with you. I was being very generous. 6 months to a year is about the right time frame. And so you, if you want to know that you are secured and have a place to go, have to be on it no later than, you know, beginning of July.
Yeah, absolutely. So now as you're hiring this first doc, what are the factors that you're looking for? Are you looking for a particular skill set? Is it a particular personality style? I mean, what are you looking for in that first partner?
Really more personality. I mean, it really is about a fit. I mean, when you bring somebody on, it's like a marriage. I mean, the goal is that not that you're going, well, let me say this. It takes time and effort as the person who is bringing you on to get you credentialed, bring you in, onboard you, you know, get you patients. All of that takes time and money. So my goal is for you to come and for you to stay, not for you to come and go. So I'm really looking for there to be a personality fit, and not even personality, hey, I like you. I mean, that obviously is par for the course, but hey, you want to practice in a way similar to me. Okay. And it's really about understanding the culture that you want in your practice or in your business. Okay. So for example, I already told you earlier in this episode that I am a multimodality pain specialist, right? So if you're the guy who says, I'm never going to write an opioid ever, you're probably not a fit. Okay. not because I write opioids for everybody, quite the opposite. I believe that there are multiple modalities for how you manage pain. But if you say I never, that's a problem. If you say I always, that's a problem. If you say I only want to do interventional procedures, but I have never referred anybody to counseling behavior modification, that's not a fit. So you have to have a very clear idea as to how do you practice? How do you want to practice? How do you envision your business to run? And try and figure out whether that person is going to fit into that scheme.
Well, and you have to do that not just for the physicians, right? So anytime you bring on, you know, a nurse or an office staff or, you know, a medical assistant, they need to be fitting in the team culture as well, right?
Absolutely.
So how do you shape that as the physician leader? You know, what steps do you take to mold your team's culture?
I think it's so multifactorial. I mean, you know, for employees, you know, whether it's the practice manager down to the MA across the board, it, you know, you obviously policies and procedures and having them very clearly defined, having an employee handbook on how you expect people to behave. And then it's really how you treat both your patients and your staff. Okay. I mean, you can't say this is my philosophy and then do something totally different. As somebody told me yesterday, probably my biggest strengths in managing these businesses has been consistency. Okay. I do the same thing in the same way every single time. So if I tell you, you know, let's say we're going to terminate an employee. Before we terminate an employee, I'm going to counsel that employee. We're going to write it up. There's a whole process for how that happens, for example. And then this is what happens next. As long as you follow and people know what's going to happen and you communicate, it's pretty easy to communicate that culture, right? And it's about being open. It's about being transparent, okay? You know, when there were great things that happened, I called a group meeting for everybody, every employee, every doc, everybody, and said, hey, this is what's going on. If we had something bad happen, let's say we terminated an employee for some reason, called a meeting and said, you'll notice that so-and-so is no longer here. These are the reasons that this is occurring, so that everybody is on the same page and people want to row with you.
So let me talk, let's talk a little bit about some sort of nuts and bolts things, because I'm fascinated to learn how you sort of set up the mechanics of the practice. So it sounds like you got a great concept for the hiring strategy, for a culture defining strategy. And that's probably the most important thing, getting the right people in there and getting the right cultural fit. I mean, we've had episodes where we talked about that, and that is just critically important. So let's talk about contracts. So you bring on new partners, and I think you had said you had something like 10 or 11 docs working in the practice. How do you guys structure contracts for the new doctors? So, and maybe you could talk about in terms of things like opportunities for profit sharing. How do you, you know, like what's the partnership track, opportunities to buy into ancillary services, you know, compensation, like how do you guys structure some of those contracts?
Okay, so first of all, let me say that I've done it both ways, where people came in as employed physicians. I actually brought in two guys straight out as partners who had been partners in another practice. I would not recommend that unless you really, really, really know that person extremely well. And even then, I wouldn't recommend it. The employment contract for somebody, even if you're ultimately going to make them a partner, because every employed doctor that I've ever hired was on a partnership track with every intention of making them a partner. But at least then it's like a dating period. Okay. I'll come back to, I really believe this is a marriage. And during that employment contract, it gives them a chance to really figure out whether we're a fit. It gives us a chance to see whether you're a fit. So two things. Number one, everybody got a guaranteed salary, but everybody got a bonus structure so that they had a dog in the fight, so that there was some incentive for them to participate in the ramp up of their own productivity. Because a lot of times people think that, oh, I'm coming on as an employed physician, they're going to give me patients. And indeed, we had patients to give. I mean, the whole reason we would hire the next person was because we had the volume to give to them. But I also want you out there in the community talking to the docs and working on growing your own referrals. And I can come back and talk about how we dealt with referrals. But so everybody had a salary. Everybody had a bonus structure. That bonus structure, salary and bonus structure was the same for every person who came in, so that it wasn't that one person could go, oh, I got a sweeter deal than somebody else, because that only leads to bad feelings. In terms of partnership, it was a two-year partnership track. I met with every single doc every month and went over their productivity from the time that they started. Their productivity, their financial statement, their share over the, of the overhead. So they knew where they were in terms of, am I on track to actually be a partner? And what was that going to look like? Because my criteria for partnership was you had to be covering your salary and your overhead, at least, okay? Your share of the overhead. In terms of ability to buy into other things, there were some things that were part of the practice. So our weight loss was part of the practice. But things like imaging, things like the ambulatory surgery center, those were all separate companies with separate buy-ins. Because, for example, like the ambulatory surgery center was a multi-specialty ambulatory surgery center. There were ultimately docs that we syndicated shares to that were not part of our practice. So if you became a partner at the end of 2 years, you were eligible to buy into any one of these other businesses, the same way that you could invest in anything else.
Well, and I think this is a really important thing for people to be hearing. So I see a lot of sort of weeping and gnashing of teeth from young physicians online about like, oh, they, you know, can you believe this contract, you know, has a 5 mile radius non-compete? Can you believe this contract has a 2 year partnership track? You know, these old docs just don't know whatever, you know. It's like, okay, I understand your frustration, but what you don't appreciate is that, you know, you're coming into a practice that was built over the last 10, 15, 20, 30, 40 years or whatever. And people put in a lot of risk, people put in a lot of time, people put in a lot of sweat equity. And so you're frankly not entitled to the same level of, you know, immediate compensation that you may think you are, just by virtue of having joined the group. And so it's like you said, it's a marriage. You know, you want it to be beneficial for both parties. So as the employer, you know, you want to offer, you know, good terms, you want to offer, you know, good opportunities for growth, good opportunities for income and for expanding your practice and being able to buy into some of these ancillaries. But as an employee, you know, you also want to come in with an attitude of, okay, I'm the young guy. I'm kind of dead weight right now. I want to build up my practice. I want to show that I'm, you know, an equal partner. You want to, if both parties are coming together and saying, I want to make the other person better, then it'll work out. If both are coming together and saying, I want to get what's mine, it's for sure not going to work out.
And that comes back to that whole fit thing. Okay. And it's part of the reason, and that those are some of the questions that I would ask when I would interview somebody. But it's also part of the reason that every month I would meet with them and go over their financial statement. I think the thing, to your point, that a lot of the younger physicians first starting out don't, especially the employed ones, don't really understand. There was a lot of time and money that went into credentialing you, getting you hospital privileges. We put out the money to get your malpractice up and running, all right? We went out and we marketed you. We put ads in the newspaper, or we did social media ads, or we did TV. We sent our marketer into various referral sources to try and get you new patients. And then you started on day one, you got a salary. We didn't actually collect your money for probably a month from the day that you started. And on the day you started, you didn't have a full practice. So it's probably 6 to 9 months before you're actually having paid off all that money that we just put into you. So why would we take on a new person just to lose money, right? You'd think I was a really crappy business person if every time I brought on a doc, we were losing money, right? We have to at least break even.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Well, I want to talk a little bit about some of the ancillary services, because that's something that you've done just exceptionally well. And it's, you know, it's kind of a scary thing for people to consider, or sort of a black box for a lot of people. So can you talk about some of the ancillary services that you guys created, and sort of what were the, you know, was there a particular order that you added those? What were some of the obstacles that you had to overcome in creating those?
So probably that the first and biggest was the ambulatory surgery center. As you know, obviously as a pain specialist, we do multiple interventional procedures, right? And so the way in which we went about this was I understood from what I was doing at the hospital, how many cases I did a week, a month. I knew what my payer mix was because I did the billing. I could easily look up on CMS what the reimbursement was from the facility fee component and put together essentially a financial projection of how much revenue I could bring in if I had my own ambulatory surgery center. At the time, hired a consultant who was an architect who was able to tell us, okay, this is what it's going to cost to actually build this out. And quickly came to the realization, all right, well, you know, in 6 months, I can easily cover my expenses. And then from there, you know, the rest is just extra. And so, you know, the reason that was clearly the low hanging fruit. I mean, but, you know, two reasons that it was successful. One, I knew my volume, and I knew that I didn't have to rely on anybody else to be able to make the thing successful, because I knew my own numbers, right? I cannot stress enough that you have to know your own numbers. And I think the other thing was I knew that was probably going to be the biggest, fastest revenue generator of all of the ancillary services that we brought on.
Nice. So you you're teaching or you're starting a podcast, and you have a course coming out for teaching folks how to start and grow a private practice. For someone who is not in anesthesiology, or maybe not in a surgical specialty, maybe someone in primary care or just not a surgical subspecialty, what are some opportunities that you could suggest for ancillary services that might offer additional streams of revenue for folks?
Oh, there are so many. So let's start with, you know, you could bring on it depending, I'm going to talk about depending on what your specialty is, but, you know, you could bring massage therapy in, you could bring a chiropractor in, you could bring in acupuncture, you could add on psychological services. So behavior modification, group therapy, you could bring in biofeedback, you could add in travel medicine, you could bring in wound care with a hyperbaric chamber for a couple of $1,000s. Would you like me to keep going?
Sure. Yeah. How about labs and pharmacy? Is that something that is pretty low hanging fruit, or is it just too much red tape?
It depends. So let's talk about lab for a second. Lab comes in pretty much three different flavors. You can do CLIA waived tests. Doesn't require anything. Definitely a low hanging fruit, easy, low cost, definitely a revenue stream. You can have a CLIA lab that has a little more red tape. You need to have a medical technologist. It has to meet all of the codes. Definitely doable. In part, it depends. I know I sound like a broken record. It comes back to understanding what your volume is, right? Because once you start to do, you know, CLIA approved tests, then you need to have the equipment, you need to have the reagents. So let's say that you are somebody who is doing one test and you have a high volume practice, then yes, it probably makes sense to bring it in. If you have multiple providers, definitely makes sense to bring it in. You can run, and then the third version is a reference lab that does even more complicated tests. That comes with more red tape, more Stark and anti-kickback law understanding, okay? Some of it depends on understanding your contracts, because lab is one of those things that, depending on who you're contracted with, you may or may not be able to send, because they may have a preference for you to send to LabQuest or LabCorp or to Quest, right? So if your payer mix, for example, is largely insurance company X, let's say it makes up 40%, and they mandate that you send all of your labs to Quest, then you don't have the volume that you think you have. You have the volume minus 40% because you can't do those labs. I don't know if that made sense to you. Same thing with pharmacy. Okay. Pharmacy, again, can be very lucrative depending on your practice, what type of practice you have, who and what your payer mix is. This is where reading the contracts comes into play.
Well, another idea that I've seen from folks is to have a space in your clinic or in your surgery center, or where you basically rent out a space to something like LabCorp or Quest. And so you're not the one that's actually in charge of the lab. You're just getting basically rental revenue. And it's still being able to offer the lab services there. Now, as you said, that's, you know, if it's Quest, you know, you're limited to say that one, and it may not, it may not work for every insurance company, but that's potentially another option.
And it can be, you just have to have the space to give them.
So when you started building your practice and you've been at it for a while, you're scaling, you've got 10, 11 docs, you've got big ambulatory surgery center. Now you're mowing and going. At some point, did you start to think about possible exit strategy, you know, selling some of these businesses or eventually selling your practice? I mean, is that something that you had considered, or is that, the plan is to still just, you know, keep it, grow it, and, you know, keep it all in-house?
So I'm going to tell you a quick story. When I was a surgery intern at San Francisco General Hospital, most of our patients were indigent. And I remember a social worker who told us on day one that the most important thing you should think about when a patient is admitted is their disposition. Where are they going? Okay. Why am I telling you this story? Nobody lives forever. Nobody practices forever. And so from the very beginning, my thought was, okay, when I create this business, when I write this operating agreement, when I bring on the next partner, okay, what's my exit? How do I get out of this? Right. And I had, you know, when I first brought on that, the very first doc, I had a wonderful healthcare attorney who asked me all those questions. You know, this is all great on the front end. How do you leave? If you talk about, you know, termination without cause, right, you're talking about how that doc leaves after being a partner. What happens when you're the doc who wants to leave? And so I actually got challenged with those questions from my practice within the first 2 years of getting going. And once you start to think about, oh, wait a minute, how am I going to get out? And what do I get to take with me? And what don't I get to take with me? So when I built the ambulatory surgery center, I realized, well, if it's only me, how do I get out? How does this end? At some point, if I own 100%, when I'm done, what do I do? And from there, I realized, no, I have to start to syndicate these shares. And A, it'll incentivize other people to come do cases at my place. And B, it gives me a way to get out. I think that a lot of times people, when there is opportunity, get very greedy and they think, oh, I'm going to hold on to all of this forever and make, you know, gazillion dollars. I will tell you that you will actually make more friends, make more money, and have an easier time both living it as you do it, as well as getting out of it, if you realize that in sharing, it actually makes everything better.
So begin with the end in mind. I think that's really, really smart. So start planning your exit on day one. No, that's good. You got to think about this stuff. And if it's not written into the contract, you know, it may be harder to negotiate later. So those are important things to think about. Well, Dr. Weitz, this has been a super helpful, very practical discussion, I think, on, you know, starting and growing a private practice and really getting into some nuts and bolts. So if people want to, you know, carry on the conversation and hear more from you and learn more from you, how can they connect to you?
So you can listen to my podcast. It's called the Private Medical Practice Academy. They can always send me an email at drweitz@drsandraweitz.com. And I will, if you're willing, give you a link to two cheat sheets that I have. One is how to start your private medical practice. And then the other is how to leverage your medical practice to add additional revenue streams. And in it, I actually list exactly the things that we just discussed.
Oh, that's perfect. Yeah, we definitely got to get those. So we'll make sure we get the links to all that. And we'll make sure we have all that in the podcast description where people can go check that out. Well, want to say very much, you know, that we appreciate you coming on. This is Dr. Sandy Weitz. So make sure you go check out the podcast description or go to our show notes and you can find some ways to connect with her and get some of that great content. Well, Dr. Weitz, thank you so much for joining us today on the Scope of Practice podcast.
Thank you so much for having me.
Private practice isn't necessarily the right path for everyone, but I hope that this conversation with Dr. Weitz inspires you that it can still be done and that it's worthwhile. It's hard work, but it's incredibly rewarding and financially can still be very lucrative. But the most important advantage about private practice, at least for me, is that it gives you autonomy. You are the master or the mistress of your own destiny. That is what makes it all worthwhile. And I hope this episode gives you some really practical things that you can do that will get you further along that path. Now, to help you as you're working to improve your practice, I want to invite you to check out the free content that's on my website, thescopeofpractice.com. There's a ton of great content on the blog, as well as resources there that can help you grow your business and master your personal finances. It's free to subscribe to the blog, and when you do, you'll get access to exclusive content, articles, and special offers. And I want to help you achieve the successful career and the financial security that you deserve. And I'm telling you, the content on the website will help you do that. For example, you can download this free guide, the 10-Day Simple Clinic Makeover. This is a 10-day challenge to help you make small changes in your clinic's operation that will have big impact on your business. It's free, and you can get that by clicking the link in the podcast description, or you can go to thescopeofpractice.com/clinicmakeover. So don't miss out on the weekly content as well as the archives of the blog and the archives of the podcast, because all that is going to help you out a lot. Just click on the link in the podcast description or go to thescopeofpractice.com/clinicmakeover to get that free guide today and go check out the rest of the great and completely free content that's available to subscribers. This was a great show with Dr. Weitz. I really appreciate her coming on. Hey, before we end, don't forget to reach out to MR Insurance Consultants, where their goal is to assist physicians in obtaining the most comprehensive coverage available to fit their unique situation. Reach out for both excellent and quality service at drpodcastnetwork.com/MR Insurance. Thank you so much for joining me on the Scope of Practice podcast today. You can also find all those resources in the show notes at www.thescopeofpractice.com/episode47. That's www.thescopeofpractice.com/episode47. Thanks so much for joining me, and I'll see you next time.
Thanks for listening to the Scope of Practice podcast at www.thescopeofpractice.com.